This is a Shift Podcast Network production.
Hello and welcome back to what I have been assured will be a proposal less, the last one to see.
Yeah, no, I think you're already sorted, so unless you've surprised me with something.
I would be slightly worried about like being like, here is a man, would you like to marry him? I'm not sure our friendship should go down the arranged marriage route just yet.
It's not like you haven't tried to sell me off before, okay? I have a very good dairy on me.
So we will keep things short and sweet after the very, very, very exciting last episode that we did, even if that was just for me and not our listeners. But just a quick shout out to everyone who has contacted us and me with such kind words. It's very much appreciated. And yeah, getting married.
Hey.
So moving on to something else that has been quite a long-term commitment, really, David, as was not mentioned because we said we were going to be doing Roman Holiday in this episode. What we are actually looking at is The Matrix. Now, we recorded this with our wonderful guest, Kate Dolan, around this time last year.
Yeah. So I got to see You Are Not My Mother at the Dublin Film Festival 2022. And given that the festival just wrapped last week, it's, a full year since we got to record this one.
This was going to be our season one finisher, but between a few things, we ended up ending on our episode 12. And we didn't just really want to drop this kind of in the wilderness. We want to be part of a season because it is such a great episode, and to be honest, I think has only gotten more relevant, particularly in the battle for trans rights, particularly when I live here on Turf Island in the UK. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we did wanted to give it the proper respect it deserved, and with the exciting news that two of the episodes that Kate directed for series two of Kin are going to be dropping soon. It seemed like a very good time, particularly, David, as she had a very special guest on her episode.
She did, yeah. I will be making my Kin debut this season. I have several scenes, including in the two episodes that Kate directed. So I believe you're all to look out for me in a bowling alley. I had to have a camera film me knock down bowling pins, and the pressure of trying to do that when there's a camera tracking you from behind is a nightmare. So I really...
They didn't let you have the bumpers, no.
No, I had to deliver a pro shot on that one. And I wasn't even wearing those like fancy bowling shoes. I was wearing normal shoes, which I was shocked they let us do in those alleys.
Well, please God you won't have ended up on the cutting room floor. That's your excellent bowling, and I think it's important that David's commitment to sport is preserved. But yeah, without further ado, we are going to hand over to Kate so we can chat about a film that frankly just gets more and more interesting with the passage of time, and it was pretty successful when it first came out. So we're going to be chatting about the very first Matrix.
And we have a very exciting guest who is, in my opinion, and I'm not biased at all, is Ireland's most exciting filmmaker, and she is riding the crest of the wave of her debut feature, You Are Not My Mother. She is booked and busy, possibly slightly exhausted. Kate Dolan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm very, very excited. I think this idea for this podcast is so interesting, and I'm like very excited to be part of it. Yeah.
Delighted to have you. Yeah, and I would also second Kate's opinion. I saw your movie as part of the film festival. It was the first screening that I got to, and still stands out as probably one of my favorites that I saw. The horror, like Irish horror, is like there's a bit kind of behind you to add to the kind of collection, but you definitely made probably one of my favorite Irish horror films of all time. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been a bit crazy. Obviously, You Are Not My Mother, we made that a very low budget as part of the scheme with Screen Ireland called POV. So it's made for €400,000, and a lot of the crew, including myself, was the first feature films they worked on, and it was a real kind of labor of love. So to see it out in the world in cinemas now, it's like quite surreal.
And actually, I did have one question, because I, as I mentioned, was at the screening, was at the Q&A afterwards. And one of the things that you mentioned was there's a scene within the film where a Joe Dolan track is used to fantastic effect. And you mentioned during the Q&A that the kind of question had come up about like what vinyls would Granny have in the house? And the part of the decision to include that song was based on that. Was there any other songs that you had in mind or candidates, or did Joe just like instantly come to you as like the right one there?
Yeah, Joe was definitely like one that was like came immediately, I think.
The man is an icon, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we share a surname. We always had a connection.
Very worrying that I did not notice that.
Yeah, no, we kind of looked at like a Daniel O'Donnell moment as well. More obscure show bandy type people, because Granny, the character of Granny in my film, she's a bit sassy, she's a bit kind of, you know, and we were like, Daniel O'Donnell's not her vibe, She's not Christian vibes. She wants a bit of sass in her music.
Mm, Joe Dolan had the wink. Yeah. Like, he had the look. Yeah.
Yeah, I can picture the granny from the movie having had a few nights out in the past. And
oh, yeah.
Like, Joe being a good part.
She definitely knows
how
to do the Hucklebuck, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. I'd say she would. I don't know what that is, but I agree.
It's an excessively Irish reference.
If you even release it as like a bonus feature on VOD or on YouTube at some point, I'm dying to see the cut where you used All I Want for Christmas Is You.
Yeah.
Because when you were describing that as like a fun little edit you did around Christmas time, it sounded hilarious.
I would love to like just put that on YouTube because it was quite the most bizarre thing.
Damn copyright.
I think Mariah might sue us, you know what I mean? She's
unfortunately.
I'm sure if you guys could get her in a room, yeah. I mean,
she'd see the value of having her content associated with that.
Definitely.
I know you've got a strong history in horror, and like one of your previous shorts, Catcalls, kind of comes to mind as well. And I know you and your pals are big horror aficionados and aficionadas, so I'm not super shocked that the film you're the last one to see, it's not a horror film, but it is The Matrix, which is, I think, moved beyond film and is like pop culture phenomenon, and as well, like even technically in the industry, kind of was a big leap forward in a lot of things. So why have you not seen this film?
Well, so it came out when I was 9, and I think I was kind of obviously too young to go see it in cinema at the time, maybe, or something. And then in general, I didn't really have, at that time, I was kind of like from 9 plus to like 14. I kind of just loved catching up on horror movies from the 70s that I'd never seen.
You were a very advanced 9-year-old.
I was going to say.
Well, maybe 9, I was like watching Jaws. It wasn't like, you know, The Exorcist or anything yet. But, you know, I think the idea of an action movie, I guess, didn't really appeal to me when I was younger. And then it kind of became this weird thing where basically, like, I had never seen it. And then I was kind of like 16. And I just kind of had to pretend I had seen it because it was such a big cultural thing. So then I like, you know, there was never really an opportunity where I was like, I'll just watch The Matrix alone by myself.
I do kind of feel as well, and maybe you guys can disagree with me here, I'm not saying women have not seen and do not like The Matrix, because they do, but is the type of film that men tell you that you have to see, a la like that the red pill has become like a whole thing that comes out of it.
Yeah.
And like that just makes me want to like Bugs Bunny know if people as well.
I do feel though it definitely had a bit of a queer female following, with Carrie Ann Moss being kind of like iconic as a style icon in it. But I think that there's definitely a very male up there with kind of like Shawshank Redemption listed on Facebook as one of their favorite movies.
I mean, I love Shawshank Redemption.
But you know the way that just became such like almost memeable, that like how many people listed it on as their Facebook one,
or like Fight Club. Yeah. That's another, that's kind of macho
American Psycho. I think anything that has like a heavy-handed twist or message and stuff, men like to be like, you know, oh, but did you get it? And you're like, I mean, yes. Like, there's nothing, you know, too subtle in it.
An interesting thing, though, I think, you know, The Matrix never really appealed to me. Even, like, the computer graphics. Like, I like films that are quite grounded and feel, you know, realistic. And the overly produced, I think, like, graphic world didn't, like, visually, I didn't really like the look of it. But I think what really made me, like, want to see it was then when the filmmakers transitioned the Wachowski sisters. And then I kind of was like, oh, maybe this will have like a more interesting identity to it than I thought at first.
That was one of the things we were going to ask you, is what did you know about it? And I wasn't sure if you were aware that it is a Wachowski sisters film. Yeah, I think it's actually going to be more interesting for you to look at that, knowing that after the fact. Like, I think if we announced it afterwards, you know, it wouldn't be quite the same thing as actually being able to see what kind of queer lens is on it.
I think that's one of the things that I'm really intrigued to revisit it for, because the first time I would have seen it would have been probably in my early teens, and the directors hadn't transitioned at that point, and even the commentary that I feel like there's been more recent commentary about it being kind of a veiled
trans allegory
and that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. I'd be the same. It was long pre, I think, the transition that it came out. Is there anything else that you know about this film or that you've picked up? Because it is something that is just so memeable.
Yeah, I mean, like, I know all the meme, like, I know, like, yeah, I think when I was a kid, like, it was on all the kind of, like, it was parodied so much, the bullet time, like, you know,
100%.
All the kind of fight scenes. There's scenes that I've probably seen the whole scene of it, but I have no contact. I think it's a great movie to like that I've not seen, because I actually don't really know what the plot is at all, even though I've seen so much of it.
It's one of those films where it could kind of be about anything, like a lot of the stuff that you might know about it. It's very strong visual, you know.
And I know the idea of the red pill and the blue pill vaguely from memeage and like weird reading about incels and stuff like
terrifying,
that.
Terrifying incel culture, yeah.
So that's like my elements of what I understand about it, but I'm glad I picked this movie because some other movies that I haven't seen, I know basically exactly what happens in them, but I think this I feel like I do not.
Well, we appreciate you diligently avoiding that knowledge.
I can only assume that as well, like you haven't seen The Matrix, but you also haven't seen that several sequels or any of the other Matrix expanded universe stuff. Like you're new to this whole franchise.
Yes, exactly. And I think another reason I kind of wanted to pick this was because, you know, when the new Matrix came out recently and some people hated it and some people really loved it. And like the people who I spoke to about it, the way they were talking about it, I was like, that's really interesting. But like this film could provoke such a reaction. And I then was like, I really should just get on that Matrix train, you know, get to know what's going on.
Yeah, well, one of the, I think, core philosophies of this podcast is it is never too late to explore a piece of popular culture.
Even as intimidating as like a full franchise can be. What's interesting about The Matrix is like the first film you can watch and it works as a standalone. And then when you start getting to the sequels, they're more interconnected. Like the second and third were, I think, filmed back to back and
I think
very much
right,
kind of play off each other in that way. And then with the new one, there's actually a few interesting things that they, with the reboot, discounted some of the things that happened because The Matrix really went into other spaces. Like they had like video games. There was an Animatrix series of like anime style cartoons that were based in the universe.
Yeah.
That some of this stuff that they did like outside of the movies for diehard Matrix fans is part of the Matrix lore. But then with the new movie, I believe they just kind of kept it as a movie sequel and like discounted some of the other things that happened. So
is it the Halloween universe again, David?
Where no, just not as complex as the tube line that was the Halloween universe.
Yeah, David trying to explain the different Halloween franchise to me.
There's just so many paths. It just keeps jutting around.
Yeah,
he had visual aids and I was just like, no, I'm sorry.
Somebody did a great visual aid because I was trying to like explain to somebody and then I was finding it hard. And then I found a picture online that was like, so this goes to here and this. I was like, kind of like that, you know, that Charlie Day meme where it's like all the like lines pointing to different pictures on your wall.
That is David trying to explain well-known horror franchises to me. And just in terms of the genre, you mentioned it there earlier. Would you not be particularly drawn to, let's say, action or sci-fi or things like that?
Yeah, I think like horror is my one true love. So like most movies I'd be watching regularly would be horror or like, you know, dramas, weirdly. I don't think there's really any action movies that would like kind of feature in my films that I love, you know, but I probably just haven't watched that many. But sci-fi I do. Yeah. You know, there's crossover with sci-fi and horror. But yeah, I think action is just one I don't really get. Do you know what I mean? Like fight scenes, they just don't really do a lot for me.
It's a bit good for you, not for me kind of thing.
Yeah, I can understand how people would totally, and I know people absolutely love action movies and there's like iconic like Asian action movies that are like seen as like on a pedestal for some filmmakers as the most amazing films of all time. But yeah, I just don't know what it is. It just like doesn't really appeal to me. But
you mentioned there about like The Matrix being known for its special effects. And one of the things I always find, especially when looking at older horror compared to the more recent stuff, is like the use of practical effects. It ages so much better when they've used practical effects compared to computer generated stuff. And would you kind of see that with part of your love for horror, especially like when things are done in the practical way, versus action movies now, especially modern ones relying hugely on special effects to do the work?
Yeah, I think I like a fight scene where it feels like they're really fighting. Do you know, so there's a movie, there's a John Carpenter movie called They Live, and there's a fight scene, just a punch, like a, you know, a fist fight between like, I was going to say a punch fight.
Technical term, guys.
Yeah, I know a lot about this kind of stuff, but they're having a fist fight, but it goes on for so long. And like, it just looked just so real because it's so kind of just they both get tired and it's just like really kind of funny, and I love that scene as a fight scene, but I think it's because it feels real. I think when fight scenes or like action scenes feel too far-fetched and unreal, like, you know, I love a movie like The Fugitive where like there's a helicopter chasing him and a train and like he's jumping off, like that kind of action I can get on board with because it feels, the way they did it, they shot it back then, it was so tangible. But I think the kind of more, yeah, I suppose elaborate action things, which, you know, just feel like they're impossible, improbable things that they're doing, like backflipping off a jet and then like landing perfectly on a thing. I'm like, would that happen?
And I think the whole thing about The Fugitive is Harrison Ford, he's meant to be a normal guy. He's Dr. Richard Kimball. Like, he is not an action star.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what works. And even like Tommy Lee Jones is obviously like tough as nails, but you're not going to be like, that's an athlete of our time. You know, like that's not the, like for someone who has obviously like done action films, that's never been the type of action star he is. And he's very much, like you say, almost the embodiment of that type of actor that feels like lived in.
I know there's probably people who exist in the world who can do a backflip and then like strangle somebody.
Yes, they are stuntmen. And also, like, I don't know how much contact sports or boxing and stuff you guys have done. It is so David's there. Politely smiling and nodding.
I actually have a medical condition that I could dislocate a bone easier than the average person. So contact sports are completely real day for me.
Is that one of those things that like your mom wrote on a note for you to get NP?
No,
like...
a doctor told me when I was 16, but I had been getting the notes from my mom up to 16, but then I got the valid one.
What we've learned is I must never punch David because
ever.
I can punch and you can break is what we've learned. But yeah, you are just so exhausted. It is incredibly exhausting. Even like, you know, you even see it with boxers who are obviously incredibly fit, like after a couple of rounds you're like, god, why are they, you know, huffing and puffing or whatever, and it's like that's really realistic. Whereas like you say, there's some action films where you don't feel the effort, you know.
Yeah, they feel like a video game.
Do you know all the thing of like WWE stars going into movie roles? Like, you've got John Cena now,
The Rock,
and The Rock and all that. I always feel that they're the worst for having like believable fight scenes because they started in a career of making completely fake. And
David, real wrestling fans off you now.
The kind of the age of the believable lived in kind of action star, we definitely haven't seen that for a while.
Yeah, and I think maybe it is with, and All Rides seem to come back to this with us, with the massive success of Marvel and whatever it is, obviously. They're superheroes, you know?
Mm. And I think the infamous Marvel bod that every actor needs to.
And that was kind of one of the things that disappointed me a little bit about Black Widow. I'd love to have seen it as like kind of more of a, like the Winter Soldier is probably almost the closest they've come to that. And that's not even that close, but I'd love to have seen it as like a more gritty, like, I don't know if you've ever seen Hannah, Saoirse Ronan's action film or whatever. Something like that, where, because, you know, Black Widow is amazing and she's a trained assassin, but she is the only Avenger, I think, unless we can't talk, like, who doesn't have superpowers, if you know what I mean, that it is.
Skilled powers as opposed to
That it is something that in theory is humanly possible, you know, whereas the others obviously have either like otherworldly gifts.
Literal or, aliens or gods.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, Captain America's super serum or whatever.
Well, Tony Stark, he's just got a fancy suit.
Well, we do think being a billionaire, much like Batman, is the greatest superpower one can have. So,
exactly.
Listen, Kate, we won't keep you because we do not want to give away any more about this film. And I think we could talk to you forever about cinema generally. But we're very excited to get you into studio. I think we're both really looking forward to rewatching this one. Yeah, it's one of these things where, like, I feel like certain things have stuck in my head and I do remember, like, the overall arc. But I think it's going to be so interesting to go back and look at it again, both with the passage of time and then also, like, the massive journey that the filmmakers who made it have been on themselves.
And also, I haven't actually seen the new one that came out in December.
No, me neither.
So it's great. Like, I do plan on getting to see that, and that's a great refresh beforehand to see the original source material, so very much looking forward to
it. We are grateful that you made the time to chat to us this evening, and we're also very much looking forward to having you in studio when you will no longer be the last one to see The Matrix.
That's it for the preamble, so here is your courtesy warning that we're about to get into spoiler territory.
Welcome back, Kate. Where in the world have you been since we recorded this intro?
So I was in LA for 2 weeks. And then, where else was I?
Was Fright Fest before or after?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It could have been just before. Yeah, I was in Glasgow as well for Fright Fest. But yeah, it was mad, busy, crazy, kind of. And then as soon as I came back from LA, I had to finish some revisions on two different scripts to get them done, like, kind of in time for Cannes. So you've caught me just now when I've just delivered my scripts and I'm carefree.
So you're ready to talk about dystopian films with us?
Yes, I'm very excited.
When did you watch it? Because I know it's been 2 months since we recorded the intro.
It was like this week, in the past week anyway, yeah.
Mine was yesterday, if that makes you feel any better. So
mine was earlier today. So okay, we're all relatively fresh at least. That's good.
Yeah, it's all fresh.
Love it.
So I suppose first things first, like, what did you think?
I have to say I really enjoyed it a lot, actually. I was much more than I thought I did. Because obviously, I remember I was saying to you, like, you know, action movies weren't really my thing, and like sci-fi kind of CGI type thing isn't my like main draw for cinema for me. But I was really gripped. I think, you know, Keanu and Carrie-Anne Moss just looking so hot. So that draws you in right away.
So when Keanu appeared on screen for the first time, I literally went out loud, "Oh my God, he's so handsome." And Steve went,
"Such a babe."
Yeah, so I think it's just very like universal. If there are people in the world, and they must be because it's the point of this podcast, who do not know what The Matrix is about, could you give a bash of summarizing it?
So it's about a guy called Neo, or Thomas Anderson as he's known in his daily life, but he's like kind of a hacker, like computer dude. And then like he basically gets chased down by these people who he doesn't really know who they are. And then these other people are like, we're trying to contact you to get us to be on our side. And then he's basically shown that like the world he's living in isn't necessarily the real world after taking a red pill. And he kind of sees that then there's like this horrible dystopian future that's the reality. So then they're trying to like battle these robots in the real world and then in the Matrix, which is the fake world as well. And that's the film, I guess. Is that good enough? That's kind of as best you can explain it, I think.
It's one that like obviously so many things about it, and I think we'll get into that, like about being red-pilled and about the Matrix and all of these things have come into how we talk about the world generally. So it is a really interesting thing to revisit the film and see where all of these things come from. And I think it is like, it's a super referential film, even in terms of like the obvious stuff like The White Rabbit and You're Not in Kansas Anymore, Dorothy. And even like, there's a bit where he is bugged with a mechanical slash actual bug. And it, for me, it's basically the reverse of Alien, because it's something that goes into his chest and not out of his chest. But yet it still feels like, even seeing it now over 20 years later, it still feels incredibly original.
Yeah.
What I loved, as you kind of described, of all of the elements that were very like built within the world, like the way that they communicate by phones between the kind of two different realities and all of this stuff, like you're thrown into it so deep so quickly and you just kind of have to pick it up as you go. And I love those films where it's not over-explainy and you get to kind of just immerse yourself like that.
Yeah, that's exactly one of the things I have in my notes. You are straight in, like the first thing you see is like basically like computer code kind of on screen, and you hear a phone call between Carrie-Anne Moss and I think it's Cypher. Joe, is it Pantoliano?
I'm like the dude from Memento, yeah.
Yeah.
Memento, The Sopranos. Yeah, I think it's the two of them talking at the start. And it is very much like strap in, guys, from the get-go.
Yeah, I was actually surprised because like obviously I'd seen so much pop culture stuff about The Matrix and like even seen scenes from it, and like somebody I knew had the PlayStation 2 game, I think there was like, and I watched them play that, so I kind of had all these like reference points. But when I was watching it, I was actually like, you know, when he takes the red pill and then he's in the like gooey chamber that he's like expelled out of, I was like, whoa, this bit I haven't seen before. And like, I was really engaged, even though I kind of knew bits of what it was about and what happens in it. But I think it never stops moving. It's really like kind of keeps you watching.
I forgot how much of it actually takes place in the dystopian side of things, like the kind of sci-fi world.
Yeah.
You remember like the big set pieces, the bullet time and whatever, but how much of it is quite a small, quiet film in a claustrophobic space, a la like Alien or whatever, before the big bads kind of arrive? How much of it is that? And I love the way as well, the grades are completely different. It is so green. And the fact that Keanu Reeves still looks so handsome when he's in that like kind of green fluorescent light is like fair play, because the rest of us mere mortals could simply not.
The struggle.
Yeah.
And then it kind of transitions into more really like blue when you're in like the, can I say spaceship? I don't know, like ship.
It is a spaceship, isn't it?
And then when they're back in the Matrix, but he is like aware it's the Matrix, it is green, but not as like incredibly green as it is for like the opening scenes when he's still like in his Thomas Anderson.
Deep in it, yeah. Mm. That was something as well, that the colouring of it, I was nearly worried that my TV wasn't tuned correctly when I was watching it, because I knew obviously going into it that they did like heavily kind of color code and all of that, but the way in which it was done, like, I think it has the look almost of anime at times, and like it's very visually set up like a comic book, and like certain frames I remember even seeing, like when they're climbing up through the walls and it's literally just like a tube down the middle of the screen. And then some scenes where it would just be like a character taking up like the right half and the left half and this type of thing, that the visual side of it is one that I really felt like I want to make sure this is optimized because there's so much work has gone into making this.
I do think we also need to tell Kate that David has a very sophisticated TV setup where you get the light, the color palette or whatever of what's on screen is like in your lighting setup.
Wow.
It's light synced around the whole room. So
that'd be wild. I'd say it's a good movie to watch with that kind of setup, actually.
The glow.
Yeah. So I'd say for you, you were like, God, my entire house is green. What's happening?
Yeah, definitely.
On a totally different note, did anybody else notice? So at the beginning, he's told to follow the white rabbit and there's a girl with a white rabbit tattoo, that it was Leah from Home and Away.
I've never watched Home and Away.
She's one of these characters. She's been in like over 2000 episodes of it, but this was the year before she was cast in Home and Away and became one of these characters. If you're one of those people who like has never seems to have done anything else except this character. But you know the way when you're having that, you're like, why is that woman so familiar to me? And like, that was not the answer I was expecting.
She was very glam, I have to say.
Yeah, she's very hot. You can't beat a good red lip and an updo, you know. The higher the hair, the closer to God.
I think that's another thing I liked about it, is like when I was that age when it came out, I didn't like that aesthetic, that kind of like 90s grungy,
like cyberpunky.
I think you have to talk about the aesthetic of the fashion because there's a Matrix look,
yeah,
like PVC and latex, the new metal boots, the long leather coat. Like, I'm not saying none of these things existed pre to the Matrix,
yeah,
but like if you saw someone dressed like that, you'd be like, does he think he's in the Matrix, you know?
Did you ever hear of a store called Cyberdog over in London?
Mm-mm.
No.
I'm honestly, I don't even know if it still exists, but in like 2003-04, I remember on a trip over to London going to this for the first time. And it was very much that like super shiny neon aesthetic, but like PVC and leather, and kind of you get those belts that had like programmable LED displays so you can put like messages to read on it. So it was the very much like digital punk era. And so many of the outfits that I saw when they came up on screen, it was like, oh yeah, you probably got that in London.
Yeah.
And the music is so specific. Mm. So I watched it with my partner, who will be more, has been to download more than I have. Let's just put it that way. I have been once. It was fine. I will never go back. But again, when he goes out with the white rabbit girl and her posse of, is he dealing in mini discs also? Is that what he's doing? Because when they pull up the technology, and it looks very much reminds me of my old mini disc.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like, that was the one part I didn't really get what was going on.
I'm assuming maybe they're like virtual worlds that he has created because he's a hacker. I like the way hacker is always a very broad term in these films. It's like, what do they actually do?
So he made like a sexy nightclub and then they're like, do you want to come to it?
I don't know. I'm honestly not sure. He definitely gave them what looked like a mini disc. But then, yeah, they went to a nightclub.
Big bisexual energy off the pair of them as well that I did,
yes,
not pick up in my childhood viewing.
It's a real queer movie when you watch it, I have to say. Yeah, big time.
To be honest, in some ways, it's amazing that we've gotten this far without talking about it. And I know the Wachowskis have said they have absolutely no issue with it now being read as a trans text, but it's not a stretch,
no,
like at all, to look at it that way. And like, I think it was Lana rather than Lily said something quite interesting. It was like, if you're looking at it now, you're looking through a trans lens, it just shows that art is always evolving. The idea of your own body not being real, and then the idea of having created a digital self, even like if you want to be super, super prescriptive about it, the idea of there is a pill or like medicine you can take that will have you in your own body.
Yeah.
That one I think like is very, very, I'm not saying they meant something quite that literal. You know, there's sometimes something happens in the life of a creator and people go back and look at their art and are like, haha, you know, and you're kind of like, ooh, that's a reach, bud. But I think it's all there. Is it also not insane that this was their second film? Their first one was Bound. Can you imagine that's your second movie? And then you can basically do whatever you want for the rest of your life.
Well, I was reading that apparently they had sold a script to big studio, whatever studio did this. And then they basically were like, they got kind of a couple of other deals like on the back of that one to do Bound and then The Matrix. But they sold a script called The Assassins, which they didn't direct. And then they ended up directing Bound. And then I think they were like really pushing to direct The Matrix because they had written the script. And then it was a really hard sell. And actually, it was interesting what you said about the kind of anime look. Apparently, they got like these comic book artists to do a 600-page storyboard for like every single shot in the movie. To be like, this is how it's going to work. Because like, obviously, it was so complicated.
That is incredible back work. And that's not even pre-production for the film. This is like development for the film. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. That's the kind of what I picked up on. So that's like crazy that like, obviously, at the time, it was obviously the budget was 60 million, which with inflation now would probably be like, what, like, I don't know, something much more.
Things were cheaper in the 90s. But yeah, even I think it is like a bit of a, it's still an incredible vision, but it's a truncated vision. Like I was reading about how the character Switch, who is the kind of the girl with the blonde pixie haircut, and she's in white when everybody else was in black. She was initially supposed to be very androgynous and played by a male actor in The Matrix. I might have this backwards, but like, a female actor, Isis, and a male actor.
She does kind of change into a man.
Yeah, but it is the same actress, whereas what they were actually pushing for was to have two, like, androgynous but clearly different gendered people. And then when she is killed, her last words are not like this. So the idea that she's, like, not in her right body. Was it Lana or Lily in the interview? One of the girls was saying, like, it was a bridge too far for... corporate America was not ready to have that discussion. So, like, I think a lot of the explicitly trans stuff may not have made it. But it is incredible to think, like, what a vision it is, and that wasn't even their whole vision, if you know what I mean. That there are things that, like, obviously... like, Kate, you'll know better than me and David. I'm sure there's always things that you have to give up on for one reason or another.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So many.
It looks like you're having, like, a greatest hits that never was kind of rolling.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, yeah. You always have kind of, things you want to do, but then forever, whatever reason, you can't do them.
But choose your battles of it all.
Yeah, it's a big compromise a lot of the time. But I think, like, it's very clear the kind of, you can definitely feel their experience within it. Oh, like it doesn't kind of, it's definitely not, I don't think it's sanitized by the studio at all. Like it's a very weird movie and original and like has a lot of dark themes about, do you want to live authentically but your life is horrible, or do you want to live like a fake life? Which I think is very, I think that like when I was watching, I was like, whoa, they really have projected our future.
And obviously there is no way they can have known this, but Jesus, it's incredibly on the nose. And then I'm like, how soon do we talk about incel culture? When do we drop that in, that light topic? Like, it, you know, a lot of the things, even like so many of Morpheus's quotes, and I'm like, this man's either a genius or has like an, you know, inspirational Instagram account. Like, it could kind of go either way. But this idea, I think if you are having a shitty time in any aspect of your life, you feel like you don't belong, is one of the most seductive things there is that there is a real better world or version of you, or something that is right and true. And also, people love the superiority of spotting that, or of saying that, or of being like, you know, oh, well, you're a part of, you, wake up, sheeple, you know, that kind of thing.
One of the other things that kind of concerned me was how innate all of the answers came to him.
Yeah.
That, like, there was a lot of this kind of like, but I knew it all along, or it was always inside me, that it kind of going with the incel culture type thing of like, you don't need actual like science or fact or information. Like you can just follow on gut instinct and you already know how to kind of solve all the problems.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's another one of the great tropes. It's like that someone comes along to your life and says that you are extraordinary and you are special. You're a wizard, Harry, like whatever it is. And as David says, that it's inside of you all along. It's not like you have to do like, Chris Evans became Captain America because he had like the purest of hearts, because he was the special all along. You know, it is that idea that all you need is, usually it's a wise man with some sort of accent seems to be the main kind of thing that you need to turn up into your life and be like, here, this is who you really are. And we know deep down you've always known. All the language like that you are a slave and everyone else you're born into bondage, a prison you can't see or taste or touch. And I'm here to break you out of that. You know, there, I think there is something like incredibly seductive about it. And Morpheus is like a very seductive character. That so anyone who comes in and like appears to know all the answers and can also knows kung fu, I think is, you know,
yeah,
you're going to be like, this guy seems to know what he's at.
I didn't really realize there was like that kind of like training montage, but they're just like loading floppy disks into him with the dojo fight between them. I was like, I'm loving this, wow.
The thing I liked about it, and like, this is, geez, neither today nor yesterday, but I was a brown belt in taekwondo, so like I have done martial arts, is I do feel like obviously all the action scenes are like crazy and that's what they're known for, but there is a basis of reality in there, like all the moves and things like that. And I think that's kind of why they work, and that's why even when they introduce bullet time later, it is situated in some sort of reality. Whereas, you know, the way sometimes I feel like if you throw in like, oh my god, crazy fight moves, there's nothing real about them. Whereas even like, you know, when if they smash into something or whatever, it feels very visceral and it feels like there are stakes. And I know it is, if you die in the game, you die in real life. Like if you die in The Matrix, you die in real life. But it does feel like that. It does feel like there are consequences as opposed to just cool shit.
That's actually, yeah, that's one thing I really surprised me about it and how much I liked it was, I'm not a big fan of fight scenes and action movies in that way. But I think I'm not a fan of like action movies that, where the violence feels like fake. And I feel like it was, it felt very real and like the sets felt real and like, compared to like, I watched, on my way back from LA, I watched Spider-Man No Way Home. And like, it just, like, there just felt like there was no stakes ever because you're just like, well, Spider-Man always wins and then that's it. And then
there's been three of him in our lifetime. So he does just keep coming back.
And everything looks fake because it's all shot on a blue screen. And you're like, nothing's real. Whereas Matrix, which is set in a fake world where nothing's real, everything felt really real and it kind of felt gritty, like a David Fincher movie or something.
There was a feeling of it very early in the movie, like a very typical 90s American action movie. And I think even the dialogue, some of it can be very like blunt and reflect that. And then it slowly kind of weaves in with this kind of visual style of more anime and like nearly a kind of more Eastern philosophy kind of on top of all of that.
But it didn't feel too like exploitative.
Yeah, exactly. Like I felt the kind of, the more it got into the Matrix stuff, it went into like real excess with some of the violence as well. And you were learning the rules of the Matrix environment that like, even though it was maybe hyper, like thousands of bullets, loads and loads of guns, like huge backflips being done that aren't like real world kind of stunts in the kind of kung fu side of things. Because you were invested in the normal rules aren't to play here, you stayed kind of, it never felt like it was going into complete unbelievable territory because you were still trying to work out what was believable in the Matrix.
The biggest betrayal in it of Cypher, like that's a human moment. Trinity confessing her love to Neo is a human moment. Like it is actually, the human moments are the things that drive it together for the most. And even Agent Smith has almost become human in how much he hates humans. Like machines and AI don't care about us. Whereas he has a real visceral hatred of this world and everything in it, and all he wants is to get away from it. And that's what drives him to go beyond what the other, if I say replicants, but different film, what the other agents do. So I think like, yes, it is obviously this incredible world that, you know, blew the bloody doors off and, you know, whatever, but like everything in it is still intrinsic. The key things in it that make it a great film are still intrinsically human stories.
One thing I did actually love as well, there was a real, I felt like, horror movie throwback of the trope of a tank lurching back for the kind of one last attack on Cypher, the real like stumbling from the dead and like got the gun kind of moment.
Yeah, it had lots of kind of horror-y elements that definitely drew me in that way, that felt like, yeah, kind of a bit gross and a bit scary. And you know,
even like the body horror thing of like the kind of the bits, yeah, kind of stuck in. And
how on the nose of a birth metaphor was it, where he wakes up in like a tub of goop and then comes through a tunnel and has like a tube that, you know, he's then detached from and then he can live on his own. He like shaved all his hair, including his eyebrows. He lost 15 pounds for that scene where he wakes up. And I think it does all work in terms of that he is this atrophied husk of himself. Because as was literally the first thing we said, Keanu Reeves, notably a handsome man.
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed that, those kind of bits of it. And I mean, like, Keanu's amazing. Like, I feel like I was reading a little bit about like how they made the film after I watched it. And like he like did so much training to be able to do all the fighting, and he had like hurt his back, like his spine, while they were filming some of it. And like he kept filming the scenes and like training even though his like spine was dislocated or something. And I'm just like, Keanu, you just like are so committed. And like, I love, they apparently offered that role to Will Smith. And then he turned it down because he was like, I don't know what the fuck this movie is.
He said that's like, his instincts are usually pretty good. And he's like, that's the one time I totally got it wrong.
But then Keanu just like, obviously is just like, I love weird shit. I'd like, sign me up, I'm here.
But there was a couple of other contenders that I'd heard that Nicolas Cage had turned down the part. And the studio, it was Warner Brothers, wanted Brad Pitt or Val Kilmer as well. And Leonardo DiCaprio was in like final stages of accepting the role. But then he turned it down because after Titanic, he was like, that was his big spectacle movie. And he didn't want to do another visual kind of one like that.
I could see Val or Leo, definitely. Like Nicolas Cage, like obviously he is amazing, but it always leans into the very weird. And I think that, again, Keanu being quite human, because I think he would have been, I don't know if controversial is the right choice, but no one took Keanu Reeves seriously. And there are touches of it where they're like,
cute but not that bright, as the Oracle refers to him as. And then even when Morpheus makes his first big leap and Keanu looks at him and goes, whoa, it's real, like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Point Break kind of surfer dude. So I think they do know that they're playing into it. There was one other particular actor that I just want to shout out to the career of Mr. Hugo Weaving. The Matrix, The Lord of the Rings, The Red Skull in the Marvel franchise. He's the voice of Megatron. He's the voice of Rex from Babe, which, I mean, key in the canon. He's like the iconic character of V from V for Vendetta. He's Mitzi in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And then like you've got Black 47 and Melrose Place and some serious, like, you know, kind of higher art. Incredible career. Amazing. And to be in, like, getting those big franchise checks, but still making interesting work. Like, well done, sir. You've really kind of balanced those two things.
So cool.
Yeah, and he's one of the ones that the sequels kind of since. The most recent one, Revelations, he didn't make the comeback for. And so his role, Jonathan Groff stepped in to play the role kind of that Hugo Weaving had in this one. So I'm always kind of dubious about the recasting of really iconic roles like that. You haven't seen the sequel to comment on that? No.
No, I was going to try and watch some more before I came on this, but I was like, oh, I don't want to sully my, like, opinion. I wanted to have a clear opinion of the first one and just kind of like be able to do that. Yeah.
I think that's fair, because I think the first one is the best one. I haven't seen the most recent one. As much as, actually, ironically, even Will Smith turned it down, Jada Pinkett Smith is it the second and third ones?
And the most recent.
So, like, I haven't seen the most recent one, but, like, it's a hard act to follow, because it's like, hi, here's something that you have literally never seen before, and presenting a worldview that, like, isn't the norm that it is now. It was, like, it's amazing that it does still, and I think we said this before, but it does still manage to feel as fresh as it does for something that just permeated, like, every aspect of culture.
Yeah, because I think it's so relevant to today, you know what I mean? I think there's, like, definitely a want to just, like, live in the ether and just be like, ignore dystopian reality.
And the feeling that, you know, the big machines, the Amazons and whatever, yeah, control our lives in, like, a very direct way.
Jeff Bezos coming chasing us down the street.
Yeah, and you know he'd run like that as well. The Sentinel robots also, the scary jellyfish guys. I've noticed that nothing, Sentinel is never anything good, because they come after you in X-Men, yeah, as well. So if anyone's like, I've invented a Sentinel, it's like, kill it with fire, because it's in the end, it's going to come after us.
I feel like Elon Musk's going to be like, I invented this Sentinel robot. We'd be like, fuck's sake.
We knew it.
I have to say, the Sentinel scenes where they were like flying around jellyfish, those were definitely, I feel like, the dodgiest CGI, yeah, where I was like, this maybe hasn't aged as well as the rest.
There was one particular scene with like a laser thing where it really looked like hand-drawn animated as opposed to even computer, yeah, graphic stuff. That,
like, there are obviously one or two ropey moments, but for a film that is obviously has so much CGI from 1999, it still does look great. And I think a lot of that does come down to design. Not like, obviously improved technology helps, but if it's designed and well thought out, I think you'll make that leap.
To the point, like you were saying at the beginning, Kate, about the 600 page like storybook and how they were so visually thinking about this movie from the get-go, I think that really does translate on screen, that these scenes weren't just like things they filmed that they thought, like, let's add in effects to enhance it at the end. Like, the building it from scratch and really conceiving like the visual before kind of making anything was so apparent in some of the scenes. That the scene where you've got like the really iconic tunnel of guns kind of appearing around, yeah, and all that, like, that had to be in the mind's eye long before kind of anything was filmed like that.
Definitely. Like, I was reading something about Marvel, not to bitch about Marvel too much, but I was reading, because like Spider-Man No Way Home, I saw loads of behind the scenes shots where they like loads of shots that were even on a street was just complete blue screen, and they didn't like even build the sets at all. But they also like to just change completely how sets and locations look after they're in the edit, so that if they build a set, they can't change it completely. So they just shoot it on blue screen, because then they can like build an entire world that looks different than what the visual. But I think that just shows so much when you haven't like dedicated a vision of like, this is what it's going to look like and this is why. And then it just feels wishy-washy, like, oh, now they're in another grayish space that looks really boring. And I think that's why The Matrix is so, because like the sets feel really thought about and like textured. And like, I think as well, it's probably because it's shot on film, but I think it like has a real like strong look that really like drew me in.
It doesn't feel digital.
Yeah, ironically.
For a film that is all about the digital world. And I know I have definitely said this at least more than once on this podcast, but I do stand by it. I think part of the reason Lord of the Rings has aged really well is because so much of it is miniature work, or so much of it is in-camera stuff, so much of it is these in, like, they're a set of DVD extras if you to get your teeth into. But in terms of, yes, that these are actual set, and even I think you can see it in the actors' performances, because obviously if you think about Lord of the Rings too much, it's intrinsically quite silly and overblown. So if you don't have that sense of realness to anchor this story and to anchor these performances, and like that half the time, like that they are gross and sweaty and dirty, and as opposed to sanitized, like that's, I think, what gives it the emotional resonance that people will stick with these characters through thousands of pages or hours and hours of film. So I think, yeah, bring back more reality into our films. And yeah, the big irony is obviously The Matrix is a film that is challenging the very nature of reality, but if it had been done completely digitally, would it have been too Uncanny Valley? Would it have worked? Would we have had any connection? Because I think with Trinity and Neo, you really do connect with them as people.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, no, it definitely, I just had a very strong, yeah, vision and yeah, personal connection, I think, to it much more than I would for like any modern action movies, which I think is down to, obviously, the Wachowski sisters being great at what they do probably. But yeah, it was so good. I really enjoyed it.
I love when people are surprised, like they enjoy it more than they think they will, which is nice. I don't think we've had anyone who like hated whatever they watched.
Well, I know Jen Gaddon had feelings about The Notebook, but hatred maybe was a little bit further.
Oh, I forgot about Jen and The Notebook. One of the other, to kind of move slightly away from, again, I had completely forgotten about this because I think I didn't see it in the cinema, but I think I saw it like on TV like early 2000s, so like it's been a while since I've seen it. The Cypher character, the Joe Pantaleone, you kind of get, like, obviously when he's viscerally killing people, not great, and also he's killing people in real life as opposed to like what the agents are doing in The Matrix. But when you're like, I've been sold a crock of shit, I've been miserable for a really long time, I can kind of see where he's coming from here. Or am I totally, like, if somebody, now obviously, thankfully, at the moment, I am currently not miserable. But if someone came to me and said, you can give up your actual life for a real life, and the real life was terrible, like, I think you would probably be a bit like, oh, can I just go back to my nice coma life now?
Yeah, I feel like taking everyone down with him was maybe the cruel part.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I think he went a little bit extreme about it, but I can understand why you would feel betrayed by this. And also that the truth is really ugly, and I was actually happier when I didn't know.
Yeah, the food thing got me. I was like, when he was eating his steak, and then when they're eating the gruel on the ship, and I was like, maybe I would prefer to just be in that eating some pizza or something. Do you know what I mean?
He is like, I know this is not real, but it tastes real, and god damn it, that's good enough for me. He's clearly not a sympathetic character. I'm not quite that deranged. This is not going to be, I ended up being like an Ed Gein apologist at one point accidentally on this podcast. But like, I think you can be like, it's not necessarily a straightforward choice because their lives are so horrible and difficult and they're being hunted and killed.
Well, I think like, it's really interesting when you contrast this against that Black Mirror episode about...
Yes.
Changing Power. Yes, that was the one. That had this kind of concept of being able to go into a kind of Matrix style utopia to live out your existence, and selling it as a kind of thing of nearly commercializing being able to be in the Matrix kind of thing. That I think that is very interesting as a kind of an evolution of the idea that was introduced in The Matrix, and how it more reflects the more recent everything being a Jeff Bezos sellable property.
And Morpheus is very clear on this. He's like, the only thing that I offer you is the truth. Like, he's not necessarily saying, like, you know, take this pill and you'll be a millionaire in a beautiful new world or whatever. Like, he is saying, like, all I can show you is what's true, and you can go back and you won't remember any of this. So, like, to be fair to the man, he doesn't, like, sell you snake oil. But, yeah, I think human curiosity is such a driver. Like, would you honestly be able to be like, no, I'm fine, thanks, jog on.
One thing that kind of... it confused me, and maybe I like missed something towards the end, but like, what is their end goal here? Like, is it to wake everyone up from the sheeple pods and like live in the horrible dystopian burnt land?
Yeah, I think that we don't see Zion, which is the only human city.
Yeah.
So I think it's to basically liberate Zion and build their society from there.
Wait till you see the sequels.
There's a good rave orgy in there, isn't there? New metal rave, that sort of rave. Yeah, Steve was really identifying all these songs for me. And I was like, I mean, I know who Rob Zombie is, but I don't necessarily think I could recognize one of his tracks.
Anarchy, on that note then, would you, after having watched this, consider watching the sequels?
Probably, actually. Yeah, I think so.
Like with urgency, or is it just more like if they're on?
No, not with urgency. I might like if they're on a streaming platform that I have and I'm like, oh, there it is.
Yeah. Mm.
And like the only time I watch, because I know my girlfriend would absolutely hate this like movie, and she hates like any kind of sci-fi, kind of like action-y, fake world kind of movie. Like horror movies even push a little bit for her, and she's like, has to be a kind of certain one.
Is she a Richard Linklater kind of Before Sunset sort of person?
She's more like Bridesmaids is her favorite movie.
Can't argue with that comedy.
can't argue. The only time that I really get to watch movies like this is when she goes to badminton, plays badminton with her friends.
Okay, this is so specific.
So I feel like...
this is a real badminton movie.
Yeah, so, you know, if she's at badminton and I've got a couple of hours to kill, I might stick it on, yeah.
Excellent.
You are actually the third person to mention badminton to me as an activity this week. So I'm like, is everybody secretly playing badminton? And like,
it's the new thing, Kate.
In the Matrix, we all just got loaded with the badminton chip. Like,
actually, speaking of that, if you could like call up the operator and download any skill to kind of instantly acquire, what would you request?
I mean, like the fighting is kind of cool because you can like fight people.
done. What it says on the tin: fighting means you can fight people.
Probably, like I can't swim, so probably that would be important to have.
Oh, that's a good one. And to be able to like swim without the hassle of learning to swim.
Yeah.
Because firstly, Kate, feel free to learn to swim. It is a wonderful thing to be able to do. But to be able to skip that part where you're shit at it would be nice. I think that's almost the thing about any, it's like, obviously I'm not saying you could like, we could all learn to fight the way they do in the Matrix, but you can like learn to fight, you can learn to do whatever, but you just get to skip the part where you're terrible at it.
Time. Yeah, that 10,000 hours shite, yeah.
One of the other things I was going to posit is, the film basically tells us that civilization peaked in 1999, because that is that's literally what Agent Smith says, it's like the peak of human civilization.
Do we disagree?
Yeah, I mean, Prince wrote a song about it, and he's usually right about most things.
I would say, I mean, like, that I was looking up this movie, obviously, and then I was like, you know, a lot of banger movies came out in 1999, and it's only been downhill from there. This movie, Matrix, was made for $60 million, apparently, and it made $460 million.
Yeah, and that's, I think, box office only. Like, God knows, DVD and whatever. Because that was when we all bought DVDs, so...
And now I'm like, you know, now we live in a heart... The film world is in dystopia, and it's just like...
It's like, you can have $500, or you can have $200 million, and there is nothing in between.
Yeah. So I think maybe 1999, in terms of as a filmmaker, I'd say it was a peak. It's been going downhill.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of stuff in there. Like one thing that has come up on this podcast for us a couple of times was obviously like Britney being the main example. It was a weird time to grow up as a woman, in that it was like you have to be like hot and sexy but not try, and you're a feminist and liberated, by the way, so take your bra off kind of thing.
Yeah, but also if you have sex, you can't, you're a slut.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was that weird, you have to be ready to have sex all the time but not actually do it.
Yeah.
But then again, I look at Carrie Ann Moss from 1999 and like Trinity is that bitch. Like there's no, she is amazing, she's totally committed, she's hot as hell, but like, and obviously I know she's in like latex and whatever, but so is everybody else. Like I don't feel like she is particularly objectified.
No,
certainly no more than Keanu is, because again the first thing you think of is, God, that man is pretty.
They're both very like equally, and like, you know, she's doing lots of fighting, he's doing lots of fighting,
she's no damsel in distress, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's like, you know, they're definitely, I feel like she's such a badass character, and like she's badass and she can fight people and she's strong and smart, but then she's also vulnerable and it's like, I'm actually in love with you. And then you're like, oh, what a cool woman.
Yeah, it's like an actual strong female character.
Yeah, her declaring her love doesn't like weaken her in any way. It's like she's comfortable with vulnerability.
And also that her love is so strong, it basically brings him back. And also the shot where, you know, she's swinging on the rope back towards the building and the entire building and helicopters exploding behind her. None of us will ever approach being that cool, ever. Maybe Kate, we believe you. But like, it is just that moment where you're like, and again, I am not saying this is a perfect movie, but when I left Captain Marvel, I felt like I could punch walls. And I was like, is this what it's like to be a man and seeing like male heroes on screen all the fucking time? Like, I was kind of like, absolutely. And like, I am not saying it is, you know, a life-changing movie in like a Citizen Kane kind of sense or whatever, but just like seeing an absolutely bitching female superhero with a very cool 90s soundtrack, I was like, obviously pander to me. But it is this idea of, and they talk about it a lot with sport in particular, the can't be it, can't see it. So the idea that like, we just, you know, like we had a failed Catwoman, you know, we had a failed, and then we could never have a female superhero again, whereas they made like three Punishers, you know, and that was fine.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like the idea that you're now growing up in the world, like, because Carrie Hamoth, like that was a rarity. And like you said, if you were like a strong, sexy woman character, you also have to be like fundamentally broken or something to even it out. Whereas she is like a very full, rounded woman.
Yeah.
Which is
great.
Yeah,
yeah. I loved her. I thought that was so great. And maybe another testament to the Wachowskis, they were kind of dealing with their trans identities. Like Neo's character and Trinity's character, they kind of like, they look very similar, even like, and sometimes when they're fighting, they're like, they're kind of paralleling each other. And I thought that was really interesting. I was like, cool. I liked it.
Quite androgynous, yeah. We watched But I'm a Cheerleader. Don't know if you've seen it.
Literally, that's probably my girlfriend's favourite film.
Yeah, it isn't queer classic that I hadn't seen, David had, and then our guests obviously hadn't seen. But we were talking a lot about that because it's made by a queer woman, but like female gaze, male gaze. The Matrix does feel, and this is, I'm not sure if this is the right thing to describe it, it's a genderless gaze, if you know what I mean. It does feel like it's looking at everybody on a par and inviting you to look at them as well, which is great.
Defo. Yeah, yeah.
On that, like, even the scene about I can't remember the younger guy, the one who created the woman in red.
Mouse, I
think. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Mouse.
Like, him, the way he objectifies this, like, fictional character and everything, it feels a little bit awkward or clunky within that scene, or it's a little bit too, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, elbow down, I felt.
Yeah, for me, it was a little bit, teen boys aren't subtle, you know, because it was, and also that she is obviously blonde in a red dress. Like, there was absolutely nothing subtle about it at all. And especially someone who, like, is living a very stunted life on, like, a rickety cruise ship.
No, I liked that. I thought it was kind of funny. But that's also one thing I liked about it a lot. Was like, it did have kind of brevity in it and like funny kind of campy moments that were like, because I thought, you know, from what I had seen of The Matrix in clips or the trailer or whatever it was, it all seemed like it took itself really seriously. And like, you know, but then when I was watching and I was like, oh, there's lots of little funny, little weird moments.
It's a lighter touch than, again, like the things I remember would be like super hard hitting bullet time, take itself really serious. And also maybe part of it is, I don't think the Wachowskis take themselves too seriously, but plenty of people take them seriously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think there is an element of that. Like, I think they are having fun in what they do. But again, if you were like, The Matrix has changed my life, I see that we are all in a simulation, that's not really the vibe that this film is putting out. That's the vibe that you are taking on.
It definitely isn't a film that like you should take seriously, I think, because it is so kind of funny and silly, isn't it?
It's funny, it's pretty camp, but then it also says lots of profound things that have probably become even more reflective of the world that we're in. So I think if you go into it in that spirit of this is all ridiculous, but it's really enjoyable and there are one or two thought-provoking things, rather than this is something I'm going to live my life by. And I'm kind of reminded of the whole red pill thing. For those who don't know, and if you don't know, good for you. Taking the red pill has become a thing about becoming like you see the world as it really is and being a part of incel culture. I think it's a Reddit forum as well, is like the red pill is actually where it started. And I'm kind of reminded of that the term incel or involuntary celibate was created by a woman for people who were, you know, not having sex, having difficulty meeting people, having difficulty making human connections. And it was originally a forum that was supportive for lonely people. And like how horrific it is that it's become taken to, because like we have all been lonely in times and you need support from other people. And a lot of the time that support is going to be on the internet, you know, because there are people out there who will be feeling the same and they mightn't be in your immediate circle. But how like incel, red pill, all of those things have been taken from women to then become and mean something they're not for a really kind of toxic masculine culture.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah, but I think, you know, it's just, that's just like people who are misogynists really, isn't it?
If it's not that, it will be something else. I know they've interviewed the woman who kind of started the term incel and had like a forum for incels and whatever, and like she is like understandably, because, you know, people murder on basis of this ideology, like, she is absolutely horrified. But the idea that it was something good that then that was supportive for people that then became twisted and targeting like a very specific area of society, there is something really sad about that.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, like, the whole incel culture is so weird. I watched a documentary about it a while ago and I was just like, oh my God, it's just like so sad.
Like, I think you can obviously be like, I'm not in favor of rampant misogyny, I am not pro-murder. But like, there is a kernel of it that is something that is really sad as well. You know, both the start of it and the outcomes of it are both sad, without in any way like defending the behavior or the beliefs. I don't think I'm subhuman and I'd rather other people didn't, you know. They can hate me based on my personality rather than my gender.
I'm not just here to exist as a 2D character in your universe. I am a real person who has thoughts and feelings and ideas, yeah.
Because there's nothing you can say to these people, you know. Like, I can't say to a man who is like an incel, like, I am a real person.
No, but I think like that's so interesting, like, and in the context of the Matrix, the incels and like, you know, or even like with the way you're talking about there, like the way that you can dehumanize a whole subset of people to be like, well, I live in the real world and those people are a threat to me. And like, it's like same with transphobic people as well, that like world they build for themselves where they only speak to other people who have their mindset, and then they're just like trapped in this prison of like, well, this is my reality and this is real. And you're like, have you ever met a trans person and spoken to them and seen that like they like to play tennis or their favorite dinner is spaghetti? And it's like, they are not trying to like attack you in a bathroom, they're just trying to like live their life and watch, you know, Dairy Girls on a Wednesday evening or whatever it is. It's just like, it's so funny how the like, you know, they set these kind of worlds up for themselves in like, and it is built online now a lot of the time, like the QAnon and the incel culture and the transphobic weirdos.
That Mumsnet has become some sort of weird like create transphobe factory. And again, somewhere that was originally like, because being a mother can be really difficult and isolating, and especially if, you know, there aren't other people in your life who are going through the same thing. So yeah, like the idea that there was community is great, and then it has become something that is attacking, by any stretch of the imagination, an incredibly vulnerable community is insane to me. And again, it's one of those things that's really tricky, because I don't want to put trans people through hanging out with transphobes, but like, if anyone comes to me with any anti-trans stuff, which obviously they tend not to, but I do live in the UK and it's more prevalent here, my first question is, have you ever met a trans person? And like, so often it's no.
It's totally hypothetical. Yeah, it's like a, but what if they did this to me? And you're like, yeah, what if a fucking plane landed on my house now? That would be terrible.
Basically, I think, yeah, trans rights are human rights. And if you don't think so, please don't listen to this podcast. Will be my main message.
Well, I'm going to pull a hard pivot and jump into my section called What's in the Box.
What's in the box?
So this week in What's in the Box, I have a selection of mostly Star Wars oriented video games. And the reason for this is there was one particular game, Jedi Knight Jedi Academy, that I had years back and I was a big fan of. And it used what was called like the Quake 3 engine, for any like nerdy gamers who know about that, which was also used for, there was a really, really good game, American McGee's Alice. I don't know, Kate, are you a gamer at all?
Yes, I am. I've always had kind of, since the PlayStation 2, I had a PlayStation 2, I had a PlayStation 3, and now I have a PlayStation 4, and I had a Nintendo 64 when I was a kid as well, and a Game Boy.
Oh, nice.
So I wouldn't call myself a gamer, because like I tend to just play kind of very isolated games on my own kind of vibe, and like, you know, they're kind of the AAA games, so I don't like to say I am a gamer, because people who actually play games are like, well, have you played blah blah blah, and I'm like, no, I haven't.
Oh, I hate gatekeeping, man. You enjoy your games, Kate, don't mind them.
That is very much the kind of gaming that I went for. There was a lot of like single player, like complete the mission stuff. I wasn't really into that multiplayer, going online and having 12-year-olds shoot me kind of stuff.
No, I did that once for Last of Us. I had a multiplayer thing.
Oh, yeah.
And there were so many, like, 12-year-olds shouting at me. I was like, this is not pleasant. Stop calling me a bitch.
But if ever you think of doing a kind of horror film adaptation of a video game, I would recommend American McGee's Alice to try and, like, snatch up the rights to, because it had been one that had been bandied around as a film adaptation for a while. And I know Sarah Michelle Gellar was in talks at one point for the lead. But it's an Alice in Wonderland story where it's like years later, she's in a mental asylum and it's kind of like all in her mind.
I remember this. Yeah. Yeah, I've definitely read about that before. Yeah.
The game engine that was used to make that was also used for this Star Wars one. And it was one of the first times in gaming that you could ever on a PC open up the command line and like type in cheats as code into the game. And there was a cheat called There Is No Spoon, as one word, that worked on these that allowed you to do like the Matrix bullet time effect with the camera in the video game. So you could map that to like any key on the keyboard. And whenever I was playing these games, I was just so obsessed. Like, it just looked so fucking cool when you were playing to like have the camera spin around you. It was like getting to be a director within my own video game. I loved it.
That's so cool. Oh, I miss like when you used to be able to do cheats on video games. Yeah, I remember my Tony Hawk's, I had all the Tony Hawk's games. They had great cheats that you could type in and they were great fun. They were really gas and like you could do all kinds of mad stuff. And like go totally slow-mo and just like float around on your skateboard and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Lonely queer kids at home on their own.
Floating around pretending to be Tony Hawk.
Yeah, exactly.
On that note, we have one last question that we do like to ask our guests, where obviously this is the last one to see. We ask you about a film that you haven't seen that you kind of wish you had. Is there any film that you are particularly fond of that you wish more people would see?
Oh, that's an interesting question. One thing, actually, there is a film that I don't know how many people have seen it, but like I feel like it's kind of a bit of a niche horror movie. It's kind of horror sci-fi, but it's it really reminded me when I was watching The Matrix. I was like, oh, I'd love to watch that again, actually, because Lawrence Fishburne's in it as well. He's in the movie I'm going to recommend, which is Event Horizon, which is a horror movie set on a spaceship, but it definitely leans much more horror than sci-fi. And it's a really weird movie, but it very kind of aesthetically similar kind of to the ship in The Matrix, very kind of gritty and like textured, and Sam Neill's in it as well. But it is extremely scary, I'd say, probably. For people who don't like normally watch horror movies, but that's my suggestion.
Cool. David, what about you? Anything to throw in there?
For me, I'm going to recommend one called Dark City, which was released in 1998, the year before The Matrix, and was kind of like one of these ones that went a little bit under the radar, but it was kind of, it walked so The Matrix could run in a way. And interestingly, there were some scenes where they filmed on the same sets in Sydney as The Matrix did.
Oh, cool.
But it has a bit more of a kind of like film noir, Fritz Lang Metropolis kind of vibe of like all of the cityscapes, and definitely kind of more out there weird sci-fi, but has like Kiefer Sutherland, Jennifer Connelly, Richard O'Brien, really interesting cast.
That sounds great, David. I've never even heard of it. Event Horizon I had heard of, but I haven't heard of this.
Yeah, this one, I remember seeing it when I was living in San Francisco. There was a brilliant Midnight for Maniacs movie screening event that every 2 weeks, they used to do a double bill of like two films that were kind of paired together thematically. And they one time did The Matrix with Dark City pairing.
Oh,
and
cool.
It was a really interesting kind of see the two of them together.
I once went to a Bruin View that did Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. So very different vibes and a lot of beer, but like 10 out of 10. Can't recommend enough. In line with this, what I would be recommending is, and I don't think it's a little seen, but I will say I definitely think it's really underseen. I think we just don't talk about it anymore, is I'm going to talk about Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men.
Banger.
Which like is a banger of a film. It slaps. It has one of the most incredible tracking shots that I have ever seen. And it has Clive Owen as sort of a chiseled version of Keanu's baby-faced man who has no idea what's going on but has found himself in the middle of a situation. For those who haven't seen the film, it's a dystopian world, but
we can't have kids anymore as a species. We don't know why. And we only see news footage of this. We don't know. And baby Diego, who is like 37 years old and is the youngest person on Earth, is killed. And then in the course of this film, a pregnant woman emerges. So obviously protecting her becomes a priority. In terms of a dystopian world, it is that thing that we're talking about. Like, there ain't no, there. If there is any CGI in there, it is minimal. It is like these sets. It is this world. And it is the idea of something, a world lacking in hope. You know, what becomes of that? And I think it's technically great. I think the characters are really strong. And I think it is something that, like, when it came out, everyone said it was great. We all thought it was great. And then it just sort of seemed to disappear. Like, it's never something that really comes up at the moment. So I think it's 06, but I think it's definitely worth revisiting and having a look at.
Especially in the light of, like, The Handmaid's Tale and similarities nearly in this, like, fertility crisis plot. I'm surprised we haven't had a bit more of a resurgence in the conversation about it. But
what is that, David? You'll probably know this, but there's a series, The Last Man, where like all the men disappeared. Yeah. So like, I think we do come around to versions of this eventually. Like it was like the what if kind of scenario we do always come around to. But I think Children of Men is like an incredible film. I think it's a filmmaker's film as well, because like, it's not like a wild story full of MacGuffins and whatever, but I think how it is technically put together, and like I said, the shots, some of the shots in there are amazing. And it doesn't need to go as hard as it does in that area. You know, I don't think it's not like, you know, something sci-fi or fantasy or whatever that needs those things, but I think it just really elevates it. But it's also, it's not showy. It's not like, look how great this tracking shot is. You know, it kind of fits in with the world, but I think it is something, I think it's just, for lack of a better way of putting it, it's an incredibly well put together film. And again, you know, since it's dystopia week, that's my recommendation.
Stunning. Three amazing dystopian films, I'm sure.
Fill your time with bleakness.
Well, on that note, Kate, thank you so much for joining us, and especially for managing to squeeze us in, for you are Ireland's busiest woman. I think it is fair to say at the moment. Anything to look out for from you coming in the future? Loads of stuff by the sounds of it.
Probably not for the distant future, some of those, but obviously you can watch You Are Not My Mother.
See the film David Fitzgerald described as the best Irish horror film he's ever seen.
It's true.
Put that on the poster.
Thank you. Yes, do. Apart from that, I mean, I'm just, working away, and you can follow me on Twitter and listen to me talk about like cats and stuff like that if you want as well.
And they're cute cats, can't argue with it.
Yeah.
Delighted we finally brought that to the airways, and many thanks to Kate, not only for taking part, but also her patience, as that got a little bit away from us, but I definitely think it was worth waiting for. Speaking of things that are worth waiting for, we have a couple of very exciting guests lined up for our next few episodes, but we haven't really decided on our broadcast order. So I would urge you to keep an eye on the socials for announcement of who those guests might be. And David, where might they find us?
We are at The Last One to See on all the things. That's Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and now on Patreon. So feel free to become a patron there. We've got lots of fabulous bonus content already available between our Oscars nomination reaction. And then I've started some text posts as well.
He's bringing back blogging single-handedly.
Yeah, who needs a Substack?
We're all very scared about the collapse of Twitter, so everyone is frantically getting people to sign up for newsletters. Yeah, but David has done a great post about what he had lined up for his, as aforementioned, this year's Diff. And then we're going to get some thoughts and reactions to that. And then we're also going to have another episode for our Oscar reactions. Will we top last year's for action? Probably not. Highly unlikely that, you know, one of the world's most beloved movie stars is going to assault somebody on stage. We can but hope.
Will you be staying up for it, Kate?
It's a Sunday, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it airs at midnight, but I'm not sure. Is that ceremony start time or like red carpet coverage?
Yeah, we'll be flying back post-wedding venue viewing, so we'll have to just see how that all goes. We have a bit of a manic weekend that weekend, going around trying to lock down a wedding venue. I think what I did last year was I followed like the first few categories and then went, well, this is, I think after like Ariana DeBose, and who again, still in the news, she did the thing. So I was like, well, this is all going as expected. I think I'll go asleep now. And I had also had work the next day. Between that and the whole La La Land Moonlight debacle, you do sort of have a, you don't want to miss it, but I think it's also very hard to, like, you can't engineer those things because they were god honest fuck ups / baffling life choices.
It's wonderful to get to see them live, but as we've seen with The Thing, some of these things get exhausted pretty fast.
And then just looking future's Patreon, There's some great stuff coming up on TV in March. My Beloved Succession is back. Yellow Jackets is returning. Very interested in tackling Daisy Jones and the Six, which dropped this Friday.
Oh yeah, you read the book on that, didn't you?
Yeah, and obviously it's, you know, very music based, so I think it would be one that you'd be interested in.
Yeah, one actually that I've started into recently, that Party Down. Have you heard of that?
Is it Nick Offerman? And
it started at the same time as Parks and Rec, and Adam Scott is one of the leads of it. So it was before he moved to Parks and Rec, essentially. And you've also got Lizzie Kaplan and Jane Lynch, and there's guest stars every single episode.
Lots of heavy hitters.
Incredible.
I saw the coverage of the new series launching, but I didn't realize it had been had such a backstory to it.
Yeah, so I've dipped back on all the way back to season one, and we'll definitely discuss that a bit more on Patreon, I think.
You'll be thrilled to learn we have also been watching a lot of sports documentaries. We've watched the tennis one, we've watched the golf one, which is Full Swing, and the new Drive to Survive has dropped. How much we will talk about these? Probably quite unlikely. And we've also been keeping up with The Last of Us, which finishes up this weekend. So there's been a lot of really good stuff on TV as well. And then, yeah, shout out to my old Motherland colleagues, whose documentary about Connacht Rugby has been nominated for a Royal Television Society Award, and Call Me Mommy, their short doc, has also been nominated for an IFTA.
Speaking of, we might have to have a discussion about the IFTA nominations, because there have been some interesting ones in there now.
There always is. You'll always get some nominees that are obviously like just have an Irish connection or a bit unexpected. And sometimes, you know, it's for the best. There's a few performances that have come up. A lot of love for Bad Sisters, which I know you have seen, and I have not, despite the fact I think I am paying for an Apple TV subscription. So loads to come up in the Patreon. And as always, if there is a guest you would like us to feature, if there is a film you want to talk about, if there is some chat you'd like us to have on the Patreon, please do reach out.
And Kate, where can you be found online?
I am at I'm Kate Mack on Twitter and Instagram.
And I can be found at David P. Fitz, Facebook. Who does Facebook anymore? Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd. That's where we live these days. So we'll leave it at that, and we'll see you when we return in 2 weeks.